This is an ABC podcast. This is the Victorian Country Hour with Nikolai Bailhards on ABC Radio Victoria.
Good afternoon. On the program today, cotton crops being grown in South Australia. Believe it or not, that is now a distinct possibility now that the South Australian government has announced it's ending a moratorium on genetically modified crops. Of course, the biggest challenge it'll face is getting enough water, but what do you make of it as an idea? Should SA and southern states be growing cotton? Why or why not? Send us a text, 0467 842 722. Also on the program today, when food starts making people sick from bacteria like Salmonella or E. coli, a team of experts rushes to try and trace and contain the source of the outbreak. We'll meet them today. Start today, though. Speaking of diseases, African swine fever has killed hundreds of millions of pigs, and it is changing agriculture and trade as it spreads, so much so that some analysts believe it's the single biggest driver of change in agriculture this decade. Warwick Long spoke with Andrew Whitelaw from Mercado Analysis about how swine fever is redirecting trade routes.
Swine fever is spreading like a wildfire throughout Asia and Europe, and in the last week we've seen it going into the Philippines and South Korea, and it's a bit of a cause for concern for anyone in the pig industry getting so close to Australian shores now.
What, in your view, is swine fever doing to world agriculture right now? Because it's much larger than just meat, isn't it?
I reckon it's flipping. It's almost as big a story, in my view, as the trade tariffs that we've had the trade war between China and the US. It's almost flipping trade flows on their heads again. So, like, a good example is that traditionally Australia imports about 50% of its pork meat from overseas, but the trade flows have now changed. So that pork that would normally come to Australia is getting swallowed up by China, which then means that our Australian pork meat price will rise because we just don't have the supplies to meet our demand. So it's changing trade flows. So pork will move from basically anywhere in the world to China now. If it can be exported to China, it'll go to China. But then it also has a flow-on effect to all these other commodities, like you said, other proteins. Funnily enough, we see it in mutton, chicken. We're seeing increases in prices in North Atlantic salmon. So we are seeing it just spread across all those commodities. But then the other one is things like grain demand. So in recent years, China's been an extremely important export destination for Australian barley. But if the China pig herd has been decimated and they utilise quite a lot of grain to feed those pigs, then the demand for imports into China will likely drop by a considerable amount, which is a concern because we export barley to China, and so we'll potentially have to find another market for that barley.
How long will trade flows be disrupted for, do you think?
Well, it really depends on how quickly life of China can get it under control. And it also depends on things like reinfection. If there's, we tend to find in outbreaks that, potentially there's you can get it under control, then a year later they have a secondary outbreak. So if they can get it under control, it won't take too long. But it's still, a lot of the estimates, and our personal estimates here at Mercado, is probably it's going to have a big influence on protein markets, probably for about 5 years. It is a massive influence on pricing around the world for protein.
And we've had one analyst predict that'll wipe out 20% of the world's protein. How does that compare to your figures?
Yeah, it's probably not far off. The numbers are probably a little bit higher. You're looking at probably 25% of the global pig herd, whether it's 20% of all proteins. Probably that forecast is probably a little bit high, I would say.
But a 25% drop in the world's pig herd is what you're working off?
That's what we're working off, yeah. At the moment, that's correct. But it all depends on how bad the outbreak gets.
That's Andrew Whitelaw from Mercado Analysis speaking there with Warwick Long.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 10 past 12. Well, with little to no general security water allocations in the Murray and Murrumbidgee valleys, irrigators further downstream are keen to pick up any production shortfalls. As a result, cotton could soon be grown in South Australia when the state scraps its controversial ban on genetically modified crops. That's the view from industry group Cotton Australia, which says GM varieties are well suited to growing conditions along the River Murray River. The state government has announced plans to lift that 16-year GM ban in SA in December, but it is still consulting with the public at the moment. Sally Seeney from Cotton Australia says being able to grow genetically modified crops in SA would be an incentive for some farmers in the state to make the switch to cotton.
The Murray Irrigation Area in South Australia was the area that was sort of identified in that Cotton Research and Development Corporation scoping study in 2014. So that area climatically would be suitable for growing cotton.
What kind of conditions do you need to grow cotton well?
Typically, cotton requires warm, sunny days, plenty of sunshine, not too much cloud cover. So optimal temperatures for cotton growth would be around that sort of 30 to 32 degrees daily maximum during the summer period.
And plenty of water.
Yes, it does like water, depending on where you're growing it. But the water requirements for cotton are fairly similar to most other summer irrigated crops. So things like corn use a similar amount of water.
How dependent is a potential South Australian cotton industry on the GM ban being scrapped?
There are conventional cotton varieties available in Australia, but the vast majority of cotton in Australia grown has GM traits in it. So about 99% contain the Roundup Ready traits, which is glyphosate resistance, and about 97% typically contain the BT traits, which is the insecticide tolerant traits. So the GM traits along with improved breeding mean that the cotton can be grown in a shorter season. So that's meant that areas like southern New South Wales, northern Victoria, and I guess potentially South Australia could see cotton production in those regions as well.
So it's potentially a deal breaker for the cotton industry if that GM ban stands, just because it's difficult to grow otherwise.
Sure. Look, I mean, it's not a total deal breaker. We can certainly grow cotton without GM traits, but the advantages of the GM traits, particularly those insecticidal traits, have just been huge.
In your submission to the independent review of South Australia's GM moratorium, you said Cotton Australia had received inquiries from SA farmers wanting to grow GM cotton. How many farmers?
Look, I'm not sure on the actual numbers of farmers. I can't see any reason why there wouldn't be sufficient interest in South Australia, and there's certainly cotton being grown not far over the border, so around the Mildura and Wentworth areas in southern New South Wales and northern Victoria, there's already cotton being grown in those areas. So it's not that far away to move across the border into South Australia.
The cotton industry has recently expanded into quite a number of new growing regions in Victoria and New South Wales. What have you learnt from those expansions, and how could that help any potential move into South Australia?
Yeah, I think we've learnt that cotton is quite an adaptable crop, probably more adaptable to different climatic regions than what we would have thought, you know, 10 years ago. Certainly the introduction of the genetically modified traits have helped that. So they've allowed the cotton to be grown in a shorter season. So that combination of genetically modified traits plus developing some varieties that are more suited to some shorter season climatic regions in Australia has meant that we've been able to see that crop expand throughout southern New South Wales and northern Victoria, and now up into tropical areas in northern Australia as well.
What are the benefits to the national cotton industry if you are able to push into South Australia?
If you look at it on a national scale in terms of South Australia and also the expansion into northern Australia, it's just about being able to supply our overseas producers. Cotton from Australia is seen as really high quality, and it's really in high demand across the world. So if we're able to give producers of cotton overseas a more reliable supply of cotton, then that's only a good thing for our industry.
If the ban on genetically modified crops in South Australia is overturned, what would be your first step? Would you be waiting for potential growers in South Australia to come to you, or would Cotton Australia be actively seeking out growers here and trying to establish an industry?
No, look, I think it would be up to growers to sort of come forward if they were interested in growing the crop. And if growers did come forward and were interested in growing the crop, there's certainly you know, plenty of resources available in the cotton industry that would be able to help them.
That's Sally Seeney, Research, Direction and Stewardship Policy Officer from Cotton Australia, speaking there with Marty McCarthy.
The Victorian Country Hour with Nikolai Bailharts on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 12:15. Well, farmers from the extremely dry Millawa region in the state's northwest could soon be applying for new drought assistance loans. The funding possibility was made at a stock and land drought management forum yesterday. Sheree von Hirschner spoke with the Australian Government's Regional Investment Corporation Business Development Manager, Craig Turner, to find out more.
So the Regional Investment Corporation already have drought loans that are available to producers in this area, and those loans of up to $2 million are there for to either refinance to help with cash flow, new debt to give working capital, or also funding to do additional preparedness. In addition to that, there is a loan coming that is going to assist producers in this area with restocking and replanting. So it's a replanting loan of up to $200,000. It will be interest-free and no repayments for 2 years, and then move to an interest-only and then principal and interest after that.
Okay, so this is a response to the letter, I understand, that was sent out to the Minister Littleproud, to the Victorian Agriculture Minister and to a number of other representatives asking for help.
Well, it is. I mean, it was timely that the group here had made those recommendations to the Minister and to Dr. Webster here locally. What I would say is that Minister Littleproud had already had it well and truly on his agenda and his radar in terms of what do we do in addition to the existing assistance, particularly to get people back up on their feet as quickly as possible when it does rain. So, yes, it's been very timely, the feedback that's been provided by this local Millawa community, the loan's coming.
Okay, so how soon will the loan be available?
So the guidelines are currently being worked on. I can't give you an exact date, and nor should I. That's ultimately going to be Minister Littleproud's announcement. But it is being worked on, and it's coming in the next month or two.
So in terms of what it can be used for, can you elaborate further there?
Sure, my word. So in terms of replanting, it's going to allow for the purchase of seed, fertiliser, the actual working capital to get a crop in the ground. And in terms of restocking, well, just that. So it will be the purchase of livestock, the transport of the livestock to get them back home.
Millawa grain grower James O'Day says the upcoming drought assistance is welcomed news.
Yeah, it was a pretty good announcement, wasn't it? But, I believe at this sort of early stage is $200,000. Not quite what we were chasing, but we're very grateful for what has been announced. So, it's a good start.
From the information that you know, how helpful will it be for you and for other farmers in the area?
Oh, it's great, isn't it? I mean, we will be chasing more because obviously it does take a bit more than $200,000 to produce a crop for most people. And, we'll look forward to the state government perhaps doing their bit now.
And I understand that this drought assistance won't be available in the coming few weeks. It may even take until the end of the year. Is that too long a wait for you?
It may be okay for our cropping program, but for our breeding stock, no, we really need something on the sort of table, you know, ASAP. So hopefully the state government can help us out with that one.
Last time we spoke, you said the Millawa Drought Committee have sent off a letter to the Ag Minister to consider for the help, the kind of help that you need. What was in the letter? What are you after?
We did ask for concessional loans, non-secured, for putting in next year's crop, and also to keep our breeding stock alive. So over up until June next year, so hopefully by then we've got a reasonable break. Relief from council and water rates.
How did you work out the figures that you think you need?
We're going to need seed for next year to plant, and obviously our input costs of fertiliser, spray and so forth. We did come up with an average figure of $115 a hectare. We thought that would cover most situations. And with the livestock, we come up with $1.90 a head per week that it would cost if we was to feed a full maintenance pellet to them.
So with the crops, what kind of crops were you thinking to plant?
I think next year there'll probably be a bit of concentration on cereals just because they do cover the ground better. I mean, we do love our sort of pulses in this area, but they are prone to a bit of wind erosion. So obviously with the state of the soils at the moment, we don't want to increase the risk of that.
That's Millawa grain producer James O'Day speaking with Cherie von Hirschner. A few of your texts coming through on our earlier discussion about whether or not cotton should be grown in South Australia. A few of your texts through, and I should say in Southern Australia more broadly, a few texts through on that issue. One person says it's a stupid idea to grow cotton in SA. Stephen from Curlwa says, when will these people wake up? There's not enough water to keep expanding horticulture. And he also wants to know where cotton is grown around Mildura, says that's not the case. One other person says, so we have a Murray water problem, so we will allow more cotton to be grown, and that's dependent on Murray water. 0467 842 722 is the text number. 0467 842 722.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 20 past 12. Now, you probably remember seeing on the car rego plates back in the day the slogan, Victoria, the place to be. Well, there is some argument that it could be renamed South Gippsland, the place to be. Farms in the region are in high demand. Real estate agents there say they're bracing for a tough 6 months ahead. One Lee and Gather agent says listings are somewhat slow because farmers are optimistic about the season ahead. However, broader industry economics means that at the same time it is viable for graziers from East Gippsland and even northern Victoria and places as far afield as Tamworth to come into the area and close down dairy infrastructure that they don't need. Lee and Gather agent Peter Bellingham explains.
Well, I think from my point of view, it appears to me that farmers can see that we're going to get a good season. We've had good rain this year. We're looking like going into a really good spring. So they're going to use that opportunity to make hay while the sun shines, consolidate and really maximise what they can get off their properties and not go to the market. So I think we might see it, and I hope I'm wrong, but I think we might see it a bit tough from a real estate point of view for the next 6 to 12 months.
What are you seeing in terms of the farm values? Are the prices influencing people's decisions on whether to list or not?
In some respects, they probably are. We did have a couple of years around 2015-16 that we saw some larger prices realised in our area. Some of those properties were achieved through targeted purchases, operations or companies that were buying properties to suit specific needs. So they've targeted the property and paid whatever it was they needed to pay to secure it. Prices seem to have levelled out a fair bit now. I think the banks have probably had a little bit to do with that because they've got a little bit more conservative and they'll only lend on what they can get back as a return. So nobody can really overcapitalise, I don't think. So I think it's levelled out a bit. That might make it tough for some of the vendors that were hoping to achieve more. It might hold some back to not go to the market, but I can't see it changing anytime soon, to be honest.
And we heard that once upon a time there was one price per acre for a dairy property and one price per acre for a beef farm. Is that still the case?
No, it's not anymore. There was obviously different prices in regards to the amount of infrastructure that was obviously from a dairy farm to a grazing farm, but what we've seen over the past probably 12 months or so is that we've had graziers that can come into the area and buy a dairy farm and buy infrastructure they don't necessarily need and just shut it down. It's always there for a rainy day if they want to sell again and it could go back to a dairy farm. But we have seen that graziers are buying dairy farms now because, you know, they want to consolidate the other areas that they farm in.
And why are they looking here in South Gippsland, and where are those people coming from?
They're coming from far and wide. We've had people from Tamworth come down and purchase in this area. We've had people from up in East Gippsland, over in West Gippsland. So we're seeing them from everywhere. There's no real one-size-fits-all, I don't think. It's just a matter of what they need, bringing them into the area. And we get rain. Everyone knows South Gippsland gets rain. I was talking to a guy in New South Wales the other day, and I was going crook because we've had plenty. And he said to me, mate, you are better off looking at it than looking for it.
And you made a comment before about you know, pretty much got sore knuckles from knocking on people's doors trying to get them to list. Do you think we will see an uptick at all in the near future in the number of people listing their properties?
Oh, well, there's no doubt, because people's circumstances change. And that can be from heaps of different reasons, but you know, age is generally a good one. People want to retire and you know, go fishing at some point in time. So it will happen.
That's Peter Bellingham of SEJ Real Estate in Leongatha, speaking there with Peter Somerville.
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Nikolai Bailharts for the Victorian Country Hour.
Well, for a long time, Australia's communication services have been measured by their ability to either deliver a voice or a phone service. But now a group of rural representatives says that access to data has become far more important than the traditional voice services. Peter Thompson and Teresa Corbin from the Regional Rural and Remote Communications Coalition explain.
The sort of technology we're using in rural and regional areas now just blows the mind of most people in city areas. It's not that long ago, as in probably 3 years ago, we're using about 13 gig of data a month. On our farm now, we use about 300. So that gives an idea of why it never gets tired. I mean, we've got service.
What are you doing with 300 gig?
Anything from, we've got remote walkover weighing with our cattle. We've got tractors. I can call up tractor on the iPhone now and actually see the dashboard if it was driving around, what it's doing. All our bores, all our water points are monitored. I was at a recent meeting and had to list off how many things, and I think we got to about 15. I just sort of surprised myself just how much we're using, plus all the Dropbox and all those business side of things too.
And do you find that you can get access to the gigs that you need?
So we're fortunate where we are and quite different to a lot of people in that we've got good mobile coverage, and that came about through resource development around us. So it is an exception, but it actually shows what can be done. But to get that, we've had to get a whole heap of originally SIM cards, data cards, whatever, to build up enough capability. And that costs, originally it was costing us $1,900 a month for 80 gig of data, and that's only 3 years ago. We're now pretty happy because we're paying $1,100 a month and we've actually got 500 gig of capability.
Just to put that into some sort of perspective, that's one family operation?
We're just an average-sized family operation, and we have two couples working with us as well. So, yeah, nothing exceptional.
Teresa, does that ring true with you? Are those the sorts of stories you're hearing about the bills that are being run up around regional Australia?
Absolutely. Affordability is really a big issue for regional consumers because they're not just forking out a little bit more for the services, they're also paying a lot for the equipment, so extra repeaters, getting more than one phone because they need to have mobile for Telstra and Optus, making sure that they've got satellite phones, kitting their cars out.
Do you have a basic comparison that you can make in terms of what people in regional areas pay compared to those in metro?
We don't, but we do know that it's significantly higher, and we also know that the reality is that people in rural, regional and remote areas are far more dependent on their communication services, because in the city, your neighbours are right next door, or maybe even just, you know, out the door and in the next apartment. But if you're in a regional area, it could be hundreds of kilometres away.
The Regional, Rural and Remote Communications Coalition represents, I think, maybe more than 20 members. It's sort of a who's who, I guess, of a lot of regional organisations, the Pastoralists Association of West Darling, Rice Growers, Victorian Farmers, the Country Women's Association. The list goes on, the National Rural Health Alliance. What is on your list of priorities at the moment?
So the most important thing that we'd really like to see is guaranteed voice and data. We have guaranteed voice, but not data. And it needs to be in what's called the Universal Service Obligation. We've been promised a new thing called Universal Service Guarantee, which will include broadband, but we're yet to see what that will look like. And the next thing we're looking for is reliability. Like, we don't even have any minimum benchmarks or standards to make sure that customers get what they're paying for, they get a service connection when they're ordering it within certain time frame, they're getting repairs done, and also when something does go wrong, they're getting compensation.
Seems that we've now far exceeding the voice component.
That's right. The basic service now is broadband, but we're not guaranteed it, are we?
And modern connectivity is data. It's You know, it might be internet, it might be email, it might be social media, whatever it is, it's actually data. Voice is still extremely important, but we're a modern, evolving country, and we've travelled overseas and seen countries that are developing countries that actually have got far better and more reliable data capability than we've got here in Australia. So it's not belittling that we've got some really good stuff and we've made some great strides, but the way technology moves, we've really got to keep on it.
You mentioned your $1,900 a month down to $1,300 now. If you didn't have access to that, what would that do to your business?
Our business could still operate, but probably like a 1960s business rather than a 2020s business. It's probably as simple as that. So, it's not to say we couldn't operate, but it's just that it allows us to be real time. Even things like literally yesterday, I was able to see at home what weight the steers were in a particular paddock that have self-drafted off ready for sale. So what we look at is that technology is about, and we've still got people working with us, so it's not about using this new technology to replace people, which is what a lot of people think it's all about. Our big thing is that technology is there to make life better for people, so to attract people out into the rural and regional areas.
That's Queensland farmer Peter Thompson. We also heard from Teresa Corbin from the Australian Communications Consumer Network. They were speaking with Kath Sullivan, and as we heard from Peter Thompson, he says that he's not too dissatisfied now, or at least less upset about paying $1,100 for 500 gigabytes of data a month. That's a huge amount of money for internet access. I do wonder if surely no one is paying that much in Victoria. Give us a text, 0467 842 722, if you feel you're paying excess charges for, or an excess amount of money for how much data you're getting. We've also been getting plenty of texts through on whether or not cotton should be grown in South Australia. Not a whole lot of support for it. One person says cotton nor rice should be grown anywhere in our country. Wayne's been in touch as well, a self-described landholder on the Dead Darling. He says there's no cotton growing around Wentworth or Mildura, never has been. South Australia would do well to never let cotton into the state. It's killed the Darling and is on its way to killing the Murrumbidgee. 0467 842 722 is the text number if you would like to get in touch. It's 28 to 1 on the Country Hour. That means it's time to get the latest in news headlines now with Christopher Tester. Afternoon, Chris.
Good afternoon, Nikolai. A woman will face Albury local court today, charged over her role in the alleged murder of a man in southern New South Wales. William Chaplin was last seen in Gerrodgery a decade ago and was 25 years old. Police have now charged a 32-year-old woman with being an accessory after the fact of murder. She is the second person to be charged in connection with the alleged killing. Independent member for Shepparton, Susanna Sheed, has called for the Federal Water Minister to be sacked over his handling of the Murray-Darling Basin plan. Ms Sheed wants David Littleproud to be replaced by Federal member for Nicholls, Damien Drum, who she believes understands and will fight for southern communities. She says Mr Littleproud has been more concerned with protecting Northern Basin corporate irrigators than fixing major issues with the plan. A series of underground mine shafts have caused a section of Bendigo's Napier Street to collapse just months after the two-year multi-million dollar roadworks were finished. Regional Roads Victoria says three mine shafts have been left uncapped after historical mining activity. One lane is closed southbound and it's expected to take until early October to fix. New drought assistance could soon be available for farmers in the Millawa region of northwest Victoria. Farmers were told they could soon access money for replanting or restocking at a drought management forum yesterday. The Regional Investment Corporation's Business Development Manager, Craig Turner, says the loans will be up to $200,000 with no interest or repayments for 2 years. Police believe a driver was fatigue affected when he died in a crash on the Mallee Highway at Menangatank early yesterday. The 30-year-old man from Woodville Gardens in Adelaide was killed when his car collided with a truck about 5:30. The truck driver from Mildura wasn't hurt. Moorabool Shire Councillor Pat Toohey has died from an illness after serving on the council for 15 years. The Bungaree potato farmer served as mayor twice and was passionate about issues, including water supply and upgrading the Western Highway. And five Western Victorian councils will front a parliamentary inquiry into the recycling crisis in the hope of securing a long-term solution. Moyne Shire's Robert Gibson says government funding for glass recycling bins, a regional sorting centre and a container deposit scheme are all potentially part of a long-term solution to the crisis. And that's all for now. For more news, visit abc.net.au/news.
Thanks so much, Christopher Tester there with news headlines. A few more of your texts through. One person on the issue of water and the potential of cotton being grown in South Australia. One person says, why don't our politicians concentrate on supplying water to our country? Desal plants, so much time and money has been wasted on GM stuff instead of just getting on with doing it. Might even have enough water to fight fires then. Brett's been in touch too. He says, Nick, the poor people in Millawa might want to realise that they live in a very unreliable area for farming. Throwing good money at bads only going to get them further into debt. Maybe they should consider completely destocking and sell off assets. The dry times may be there to stay. Why should they be propped up when they're only going to dig the hole deeper? That's from Brett. 0467 842 722 is the text number. 25 to 1 on the Country Hour. Let's get the latest in news headlines. We've just done that. Let's get the latest in the weather with Peter Blake, senior forecaster on duty. Afternoon, Peter.
Good afternoon, Nikolai.
I won't ask you to give us the latest news headlines, but I will ask you to give us the weather. And I gather there is some wind about and more on the way.
Yes, there certainly is. We've got a severe weather warning for southwest Victoria at the moment for damaging winds over elevated parts. That's been extended to include the Dandenongs at the moment. But we'll see that probably expand a bit overnight. Looks like a very strong belt of winds to come through overnight as well, and that's ahead of a cold front which will approach the southwest, is approaching Western Victoria over South Australia at the moment. We've seen some dust in South Australia, and we'd like to see some dust over the Mallee and if not Wimmera today and especially tomorrow with that approaching system and very strong winds. So we'll see those winds increase in strength during the day. It's going to be a very warm day across the state tomorrow with temperatures in the northwest into the high 20s, if not low 30s, and even the southwest could even have temperatures into low to mid-20s, and certainly across parts of Gippsland and elsewhere it could see mid-20s as well. Now, the system we're talking about approaching has slowed down a bit from what you would have been told yesterday, so it's potentially there for temperatures to probably go up a couple of degrees for tomorrow. But the other bad news associated with that is that it looks like the most of the rainfall is the rainfall is more reduced now, and it looks like a band of rain may only affect southern and mountain areas and might be just a few showers into the northwest and over the flatter areas. So not as good as it was looking 24 hours ago, but the front will reach the southwest during the mid to late afternoon, and with that there's a couple of showers, if not a thunderstorm, possible with that. But as that pushes eastwards, it'll tend to a band of rain into the southwest and, as I said, southern mountain areas, and into the northwest just be a few showers around. So in terms of rainfall quantity, in the south we could get 5, maybe 10 millimetres if we're lucky, but in the northwest maybe 1 to 2 millimetres only, unfortunately. So it's really not going to have any major effect. As that band does push across on to Friday night, so most of the state basically is fine on the Friday. Pushes across the state during the early hours of Saturday and clears out of the eastern part of Victoria by late Saturday afternoon into the evening. The band of rain or showers behind the front, that is. And we're left with pretty much showers on and south of the ranges, but not a great deal of quantity in that as well. Onto the northern, could be northern plains, could be only 1 to 5 millimetres at most expected through that. So in terms of rainfall for the Saturday, in the east, I think we'll see maybe up to 5 millimetres. In the south, could be locally 10, and about the higher elevations could be 10 to 20 millimetres. So probably down a bit on what we were forecasting this time yesterday, but the system seems to have changed quite a bit. Beyond that, into Sunday, we're looking at pretty much showers around ahead of another frontal system. Looks like some showers coming up from the south. Most of the shower activity will be on the southwest coast. Certainly cooler conditions, but a little bit of rainfall pushing into the northern plains, but not a great deal except out of that, only a millimetre or so at the most, and in the southwest probably less than 5 millimetres as well. In the wake of that system, it's very cold air mass, so temperatures certainly, maximum temperatures certainly drop for Sunday and all of next week, with maximums more likely we've been seeing about a month ago, 10 to 15 millimetres, 15 degrees in the south, and 15 to high teens in the north. So certainly cooler conditions into next week. And pretty much in Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, any shower activities more likely on coastal stream in the westerly flow at, and more likely in the south, so very little getting through the northern side of the ranges. So windy day expected tomorrow ahead of a frontal system, which in the southwest, and then pushing across during Saturday morning. So hopefully there's some rain around for people who badly need it.
Okay, we'll keep our fingers crossed. Thanks so much, Peter.
Thank you.
Peter Blake, senior forecaster on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology. And we've had an interesting weather text through from Buzz in the Mallee, pointing out what a crazy week of weather he's been facing. 30 degrees last Sunday, 4 millimetres of rain on Monday, frost on Tuesday, Wednesday it's 30 and blowing a gale. And Buzz says, must be pier o'clock. And yeah, you can understand that you almost need one after that much change. John's been in touch too on whether or not cotton should be grown in the southern Murray-Darling Basin, in South Australia particularly, that idea being raised after South Australia, of course, deciding that it would be lifting its GM moratorium after a decade and a half. John says, when will people realise you can't eat cotton? 0467 842 722 is the text number. One other person saying they stopped cotton growers from moving into the Channel Country in Queensland, and it's still the best bullet country in the country. Thank the Lord. 0467 842 722 is the text number.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It is 18 to 1, and we will stick with the weather for a moment. And an interesting question for you. Do you know how to interpret rain forecasts from the Bureau of Meteorology? If, for example, the Bureau was forecasting 90% chance of 5 to 10 millimetres, you might assume that means a 90% chance of getting somewhere within that range. But that isn't the case. Our rural reporter Angus Verley spoke to Bureau forecaster Miriam Bradbury about just how rain forecasts are presented.
So with particularly with regards to the rainfall forecast, you'll see, first of all, the chance of any rain, which is the percentage you see in the forecast, so whether it's 20% or 50% or whatever, that's the chance of getting any rain at all. And we count any rain as 0.2 millimetres or more. So if your forecast says a 20% chance of rain, then it's a 20% chance of getting more than 0.2 millimetres. However, the numbers you see, the millimetre numbers, so if it's like 8 to 10 millimetres, that is also dependent on a percentage chance. So the first number is the 50% chance of more than, and the second number is the 25% chance of more than. So what that means is that if you've got a forecast of 8 to 10 millimetres, there's a 50% chance we'll get 8 millimetres and a 25% chance we'll get 10 millimetres.
So if we look at the current forecast for Horsham for Friday, a 90% chance of 5 to 10 millimetres. So just to go over what you explained there, that means there's a 90% chance of any rain at all?
Yep, that's correct. So anything more than 0.2 millimetres. Yeah, and then the 5 to 10 millimetres, so that's a 50% chance of getting 5 millimetres and a 25% chance of getting 10 millimetres.
So that means you've got a 50-50 chance of meeting or exceeding the bottom range of the forecast?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. Look, rainfall forecasts are very difficult to pick, to sort of pin down, particularly when it's showers or thunderstorms, which is very sort of difficult to determine exactly where they're going to pop up. You know, if they pop up, you know, 50 kilometres to the north, you're not going to get anything. So we give our rainfall forecasts in this way with the percentages just to give you, you know, the best indication of what you can expect.
Whereas I had assumed, and I assume other people had also assumed, that if it was a 90% chance of 5 to 10 millimetres, then that would mean that 5 would be the lowest amount that you would actually be forecasting?
No, it's really difficult to have that high a confidence level of getting so much rain, because 5 millimetres is, you know, it's quite a reasonable amount of rain, particularly for the Wimmera district, and it's very seldom that we would be that confident that we're going to get that much rain in one system. However, it is much easier to be confident that we're going to get more than nothing, so 0.2 millimetres. So that's what the 90% chance is there.
From the feedback that the Bureau gets, do you think that that confusion is fairly widespread?
Yeah, look, we do get a lot of feedback on that. We try to make it as clear as possible. So if you look at the forecast, it does say chance of any rain, but it's sort of still can mislead a lot of people. So we just try to get the message out there where we can. We tweet about it every now and then. We do interviews like this one just to make sure that people are understanding what they're reading, because it is really important in terms of planning what you're doing in your, you know, with your work maybe, or with your, you know, free time as well on the weekend.
So do you think it is maybe a little problematic, I suppose, particularly for farmers who are making some of those costly business decisions based on the way they're interpreting that forecast?
Look, I think that most of our clients in the sort of agricultural industry are used to working with our forecasts, and they're also looking not just at the short-term forecast there, but also at our climate outlooks. So they've got a bit more information on that score, and it's really just something for each individual person to be aware of. We, you know, the information is out there. We do have little explainers on how to interpret the forecast. So I think it's really, you know, you have to make sure that you know what you're reading and how you're interpreting it.
Do you think the Bureau will consider changing the way it presents those forecasts in the future?
I don't know how we could phrase things differently that would make the story any clearer. We can never determine exactly how much rainfall there's going to be. If you see a forecast that says there's going to be 6 millimetres of rain and that's all it says, then they're just taking a wild guess. They can't be sure in any way that that is going to happen. So we have found over the years that this sort of rainfall range based on a percentage chance is the best way of getting the right sort of impression to people of what they can expect.
Miriam Bradbury from the Bureau of Meteorology speaking with Angus Fairley.
This week on Landline, the special old tree feeding Australia's avocado obsession.
One of the best things that ever happened to the industry.
A unique export business supplying underwater treasures for aquariums.
We'll dive over hundreds of pieces of coral to find the one that's the right shape, the right colour, the right size, the right species.
And a new breed of Aussie buttermakers. That's Landline, 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV.
You're with Nikolai Bailharts for the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Now, when food starts making people sick from bacteria like Salmonella or E. coli, a team of experts rush in to try and trace the source of the outbreak. That investigation can be key to managing and trying to contain the outbreak's impact, both for consumers but also for farmers and their industries, which can be brought to their knees if things go badly. So when a particularly potent form of Salmonella was detected for the first time in Australian eggs a year ago, it caused quite a bit of panic. Jess Davis explains how a frozen meringue ended up holding the key to tracing the outbreak and halting its spread.
Wearing a bright orange disposable biosecurity suit, Philip Zeppi enters a shed full of young hens on his egg farm at King Lake, just north of Melbourne.
So we'll go in and have a look at some chooks.
Every 3 months, he tests his farm for Salmonella, a bacteria that, if found on eggs, can make you sick.
With the swabbing, we randomise it. We take a number of spaces within the shed. So these are basically small cotton pads. It's just dragged along the ground, and as I walk along the ground, it starts to get a bit dirty, I guess.
Once the swabs are covered in dirt, dust and chicken poo, they get bagged and sent to a lab for testing. Philip Zeppi has been testing for salmonella for the last 15 years, and so far his farm has remained free of the infection. But the third-generation egg farmer is on high alert. A year ago, a particularly potent form of salmonella was detected in Australian eggs for the first time, causing widespread panic throughout the industry.
The recent outbreak of Salmonella enteritidis is terrifying for poultry farmers. It presents an enormous risk. The bug is very persistent, it's very sticky, and it's difficult to remove from sites.
Salmonella enteritidis, also known as SE, is worse than other forms of the bacteria because it infects the hen's ovaries. That means the bacteria is deposited inside eggs. SE is found in egg industries around the world, but until last year, Australian farms were free of the harmful bacteria.
It's probably a shot across the bows. We need to ensure as an industry that we're doing more.
Lisa Sabo is the CEO of the New South Wales Food Authority. When people first started getting sick in May 2018, her agency started searching for the source of the outbreak. Since then, there have been nearly 200 confirmed cases of SE in humans.
Our colleagues in health, through their investigation, were able to look at a number of isolates of Salmonella enteritidis that came from humans and used a technology called whole genome sequencing. So it's a genetic-based technology that helps us join the dots, shall I say.
Anyone with a confirmed case is then interviewed by investigators and asked for a detailed account of what they've eaten to try to find what the different cases have in common. Lisa Tsabo says this process is difficult, as most people can't remember exactly what they've eaten. But the breakthrough in this case came from a frozen meringue.
It was someone who was ill, who had gone through that interview, and then a few weeks later suddenly remembered, oh, look, hang on, I actually have some leftover food from, I think it was a birthday party.
It wasn't until September last year that the link between the birthday meringue and the salmonella finally led back to the New South Wales farm that was the original source of the outbreak. But how it made its way into Australian eggs is likely to remain a mystery. Dr. Rod Jenner is a vet who advises the peak industry body, Australian Eggs.
There's been a great deal of tracing and surveillance work done to track how this organism actually travelled around the various farms where it was isolated.
He says the bacteria can survive without a host, making it hard to contain its spreading.
So it can survive in dust, dirt, in vehicles, and can travel in the wind, for example. So it has actually been demonstrated to travel vast distances.
The spread of SE has been largely blamed on the interconnected nature of the egg industry. Egg farmers often trade produce with each other, and equipment and workers also regularly move from farm to farm. All the farms infected were connected in some way. Tamworth egg farmer Bede Burke was the 11th New South Wales property to be infected just over 3 months ago.
Your whole world crashes down around you.
It was picked up during an audit by New South Wales Department of Primary Industries, who were tracing the outbreak. A swab of dirt from Bede Burke's property showed the bacteria was already present.
Oh, we just didn't sleep for a week. You know, that first 7 or 8 days was really traumatic, and we had to learn how to both decontaminate and disinfect our premises.
When the notification came through that the bacteria had been found on his farm, Bede Burke had to withhold his eggs from sale and was faced with the prospect of culling entire flocks.
But then you've got, you know, a heap of eggs in your premises. You can't not stop packing. So you had all this activity happening while you're trying to decontaminate. So it's just, you know, a stress beyond all belief, and then start planning for the worst.
But he was lucky. The contamination was picked up early and he was able to stop it spreading to his birds. Other farmers weren't so fortunate. A property in Victoria and 13 in New South Wales have been affected so far, and more than 500,000 birds have been culled at a cost of $10 million. There has been no confirmed cases of SE since June, and the industry is hoping that will be the end of it. But the outbreak has raised serious questions around how biosecurity is managed. Despite a disease becoming a national problem, its enforcement and regulation is state-based. Victorian farmer Philip Zeppi.
Government's really good at responding to crisis. It'd be great that if the government had a bit more engagement with the industry around monitoring, surveillance and compliance
Victorian Farmers Federation Egg Group President Brian Ahmed agrees and says more auditing of farms needs to be done. He says New South Wales privacy laws prevented Victorian farmers getting the information they needed about the outbreak because farms can't be identified unless there's a recall. That means trading of eggs can continue even after a property has tested positive to the bacteria without the other farms knowing.
Yeah, I think the balance is not right. We don't want to scare people. But within the industry, if we have some sort of system where if there's an outbreak of any disease on a particular farm anywhere in Australia, then the industry needs to be notified so we can up our biosecurity.
SE can live in the environment for up to 2 years, so it's not over yet. B. Burke hopes the industry won't become complacent.
You know, we are moving on, but it's certainly not only put a big hole in our business, but in our confidence and in our egg industry, unfortunately.
This is Tamworth egg farmer Bede Burke, ending that story by Jess Davis.
This is an official invitation. Me, Libby Gore, and the Outer Sanctum invite you to our grand final breakfast outside Gate 2 at the MCG on grand final day. You simply must come. BYO Brekkie, get there at 8.30.
At 8.30, Libby and the Outer Sanctum. 10 o'clock, the Could Have Been Champions. And from 12, it's Limo, Ange Pippos and the grandstand team. And then the game begins.
8.30 is when our grand final party starts outside Gate 2 at the MCG on ABC Radio Victoria.
And that does mean it's time to head off to the livestock market, starting today at Colac with Nicole Varley.
Good afternoon. Well, we had 150 head of cattle here. The numbers doubled on last week, but still a very small offering with a mixed bag of cattle. Price trends were difficult to quote due to the limited numbers. Cows met cheaper trends. Yearling steers primarily went to the restockers and feedlotters, which made from 240 to 276 cents. Yearling heifers to the trade to 258. Best of the C4 500 to 600 kilo steers reached 311. 600 kilo plus steers to 274. The barren heifers made to 255 cents. Beef cows to 240 and the dairy portion to 220 and the best of the bulls reach 272 cents. And there's no sale here at Colac next week due to the public holiday and will resume again on the 3rd of October. This is Nicole Varley from National Livestock Reporting Service from Colac.
Thanks, Nicole. Now to Bairnsdale and Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Nicolai. Numbers were similar at 290 with the usual buyers operating in a cheaper market in places. Quality remained limited with secondary and plainer types throughout. Trade cattle sold up to 5 cents dearer. The limited selection of grown cattle eased but were too few to quote. Cows lost 20 to 30 cents with processors loading cows for an estimated 386 to 484 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls slipped 30 cents. Vealers sold from 260 to 323, trade steers 325 to 332, heifers to the trade 265 to 300. A sprinkling of grown steers and bullocks 280 to 320, most light and medium weight cows 166 to 202, heavyweights 200 to 246, heavy bulls 220 to 256. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. And now to Wagga and Leanne Dax.
34,600 lambs combined in that number were 20,000 sucker lambs along with 10,200 sheep. Quality was very good across new season categories, while old lambs were very mixed in quality. The market was extremely erratic throughout, with prices swinging wildly at times. The best of the new season's lambs equaled last week's prices, but the average over trade in heavy categories was $10 cheaper. Light trade, 153 to 173. The medium trades, 173 to 206. Heavy trades, 193 to 216, averaging around 820 to 830 cents a kilogram carcass weight. The heavy portion, 215 to 230. The extra heavy suckers, 232 to 271. Store lambs sold at $96 to 159. Old trade lambs were back 7 to 15, making from 133 to 212. The extra heavies lost $30 to $40, making from 194 to 288. With the sheep yet to be sold, I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks very much, Leanne. A few more texts just to round us out today. More discussion on whether or not cotton crops should be grown in South Australia in the Southern Basin. One person says we should grow cotton on dairy farms so the latte sippers can have cotton milk in their coffee. That's from Grumpy G. And another person saying almonds use more water per hectare than rice and cotton. Now, one other text through as well on that interesting discussion we heard about how to read a weather forecast. This person says, I'm a farmer and I had no idea RE the forecast amount. I thought it was a 90% chance of 6 to 10, not a 50% chance of 6 and a 25% chance of 10, if that makes sense. And this person says, everyone I know thought the same. So it was a very interesting discussion, worth having a listen to if you missed it or if you want to hear it again. You can find today's program up on our website directly. So if you head to abc.net.au/rural, you'll be able to find it there. And you can also download a podcast of the program too. So just head to your podcast app, search for Victorian Country Hour, and you can find the audio there too. On ABC Radio Victoria, it is news time. It's 1 o'clock.
This is an ABC podcast.